that what it noise it is? Haunted house. Thank you. The Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development will come to order. And Representative Moran, you have the first bill up. And I believe it goes to Health and Human Services Finance. Is that correct? Do you want to move the bill then?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 951 and recommend that it to be referred to the Health and Human Service Budget Division, which is Finance.
Thank you, Representative Moran. And if you look at your schedule over the next few days, it's becoming the Representative Moran Committee. Go ahead and present your bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you so much for bringing this bill and the other bills to your committee to be heard. And committee members, as you know, I've been talking a lot about child care bills this year because, you know, really I feel very passionate about making a huge difference, not only in a child's life, but also in a parent's life. As affordable and accessible child care allows parents to work and kids to learn. Some of the legislation I've been working on this year involve really seems like maybe small but really important fixes, like the absentee bill, which one could say is small, but it really is huge and really creates a great outcomes for family once we pass that bill, if it is passed. But this bill before you will fully fund the child care system. Our child care system in Minnesota serves tens of thousands of children, and it plays a critical role in cultivating the development of our young children. We need to have a big picture discussion about the nature of that system to ensure that we are seizing every opportunity to provide quality care, early care, and education to Minnesota children. In your packet, you should have a summary of the child care in Minnesota, as well as the most recent summary of information about families and children participating in the CCAP. For the purposes of House File 951, you need to know that Minnesota has basically two programs which help low-income families pay for child care. The Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is a forecast program, and a basic sliding fee program, which is a cap allocation. Both of these programs requires that parents are working or looking for work or attending an educational program. Both rely on a combination of federal and state funding. A family income will determine which program they're on. Because the basic sliding fee is a cap allocation, there are always families waiting to get services. And sadly enough, there are more than 6,000 families who are currently on the waiting list. So the other thing you should know is how the reimbursement rates are determined for child care providers. So there are federal guidelines that states that families should be able to access 75% of providers in their county with their subsidy. Every other year, the state is required to survey counties to determine the rate families pay. But they're not actually using those rates to determine reimbursement because they were frozen in 2003. As a result, less than 30% of the providers have their fees covered by these reimbursement rates. And parents are likely only to be able to find 30% of the providers in their community where their payment will cover the cost. So this really erodes the family choice and the ability of providers to get paid at a fair market rate. House File 951, the Child Care Affordability Act, supports children, families, and child care providers, and would not only restore funding to those who care for our kids while we work, it will eliminate the growing list of thousands of families in need of child care so families can work and fund critical workforce support to help providers improve quality. Yes. This is likely to have a large price tag, but the cost to the state is so much more if we fail to invest. And I would like to say, you know, there's a cost to this, but again, You know, we have the governor who is investing $44 million in scholarships. And with this huge waiting list, my hope is that we can use some of those scholarships to help support the families that are in need, the 6,000 families who are on the waiting list, who are in much need of child care. So with that, I turn it over to Eric Hay to briefly walk you through the bill.
Representative Moran, I have just a real quick to clarify. This would be the sliding fee child care then?
It's a combination
It's a combination?
It's a combination of both.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hauge?
All right. Great. Thanks, Representative Moran. Members of the committee, my name is Eric Hauge from Ask Me Council 5. We represent 43,000 employees across the state, including family child care providers, which brings me before you today. We're pleased to offer our support of the Child Care Affordability Act, which I should note portions of which are included in the Family Economic Security Act, which you'll be hearing following this bill. So House File 951 does essentially four things. One, it ensures child care providers are reimbursed at a current market rate. As Representative Moran mentioned, child care reimbursement rates have dropped to less than 30% of the current rate and were cut by an additional 2.5% in 2011. With less than half of the providers covered by the maximum reimbursement rates and declining, the bill increases the rate to 75% of the market rate. Two, it eliminates the child care waiting list, which is at about 6,200 right now, by forecasting the basic sliding fee program, ensuring that parents have care for their children so they can work. Three, it increases family eligibility for child care assistance to 300% of federal poverty guidelines. In the bill, it's 76 state median income, which is the same as 300%, which will give more families access to child care. And finally, it increases funding for Minnesota's professional development system to meet the demand of providers. Given the importance of supporting providers to successfully complete the Parent Aware process, these funds are even more critical in these early stages of the rollout of the program, and we believe will provide ongoing infrastructure support to do the on-the-ground work to get programs rated in the first place. Ann McCulley from Minnesota Child Care Aware, who coordinates the efforts of this system, is here to answer questions about that if members have them. Finally, the Child Care Affordability Act represents a vision for how child care should be funded in Minnesota, where high-quality child care strengthens our ability to close the state school readiness gap, ensures a stable workforce, and moves families out of poverty. I believe passage of this act will take us one step closer to that vision. With that, if there aren't any questions, I'll turn it over to Robert Ellis, who's a family child care provider here in Ramsey County, to share his thoughts.
Mr. Ellis?
My name is Robert E. Ellis, Sr. Good afternoon to the committee members. Thank you to the chairman and the overall committee for agreeing to have a hearing on this bill and listen to us and take our input. And thank you to Representative Moran for writing this bill. I think it's important. Again, my name is Robert E. Ellis, Sr. I'm 64 years old. I was born in 1949. I was raised in this state's foster care system from 1949 to 1968. I'm a grandpa. I have three daughters, five granddaughters, and I've lived in St. Paul for all of my life. I'm in Representative Mahoney's district, Senator Fong. I support the Child Affordability Act. From a layman's point of view and a licensed provider, I think it's good for the state. As a taxpayer of this state, I would like my resources to be forwarded to programs to support programs like this. I think it's good for our children's future. Also, I worked in the state's correction system for 16 years. I retired in 2004. So I think it's ironic that I have an understanding, I think, from an insider's perspective of the state's foster care system and the state's correction system. I've also been an active member of AFSCME for 25 years. if no one has any questions, at this point, what I'd like to do today is personalize one of the children in our care and maybe familiarize you with some of the demographics of the kids I feel we're referring to and what happens to them, if I could. His name is Isaiah. He's 2.5 years old. He came to our child care 2 months ago. He's in custody of his grandma, and that's because the young mom, her daughter, could not maintain the challenge of raising this young boy. He dealt with depravity issues. He was not fed right. He was not socialized. He was not hugged. He was diagnosed with failure to thrive. He's a very stoic young man. He's quiet, and he literally eats anything that you could put in front of him, and you could use your imagination why. And it's a good thing that he's in our daycare. You could already see the improvement. He socializes with the rest of the children in our care. We have a C3 license. We could have 14 children, so we have 8 to 9 children every day. Right now, my sick wife is at home with 7 of them. So I showed up here today to do this. I would like to say that I think people like Isaiah is who we're talking about. I do, again, think the bill will help. And what I see is that this bill, I believe, will directly defray the amounts of children that are becoming wards of the state. And I'm not sure how much that system costs. You people are more knowledgeable as elected representatives what that budget entails. But I actually studied the budget of corrections in the year of 2001. And I know that's a huge budget. It doesn't stand out there now because it's within the Health and Human Services budget, but I believe that's a huge budget. And how much does that cost? So I am basically contending to you that bills like this, if you support them, I believe will help defray that type of population. And in my opinion, that's good for our state, our state's future, our state's children. So with that,
thank you.
Very little.
Does
more.
Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Okay, questions, Representative Myron.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I have 2 questions. First, are the payments made under the new entitlement program considered a direct benefit to the families?
Mr. Hauge.
Not my phone.
I guess I might as well announce it's if you do have your cell phones on, turn them off, but there's also some problem, the sergeant said, with the system today that's beyond cell phones.
I'm sorry, Representative Myra, can you repeat the question?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hauge?
Hauge, yeah.
Hauge, okay, excuse me. Are the payments made under the new entitlement program considered a direct benefit to the qualifying family or child?
Mr. Hauge?
I believe so. I mean, for the child care assistance program, when those payments
under this program.
Right. Well, yeah, they would go to the provider. They would go to the provider, and then that is caring for the child. Sort of. Does that make sense?
I don't know if there's any, yeah. Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's
Mr. Chair, Representative
here,
Moran, is that your understanding?
From the department, but I believe it is my understanding that payment goes to the provider, not to the parents themselves.
Okay.
Elizabeth Rowe from the Department of Services
there's a
lifeline might be able
coming
to.
Down. Ms. Rowe?
Elizabeth Rowe from the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative, in most cases, payments are made directly to child care providers. The one exception to that is when the care is provided in the child's home. In that case, the payment is made to the parent, who then makes the payment to the provider.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Meyer.
Ms. Rowe, is that a change or under the new bill, or is that how it's been handled before?
Ms. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is how it has been handled.
Okay, thank you. I do have one more question, if I may.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, you said something about fully funding the child care system, and then you said something about a sliding scale. Please forgive me. I haven't served on any Health and Human Service committees before. Can you explain who would be covered under this bill?
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair and Representative Meyer, I'm going to refer that to Mr. Hagi.
So the Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, right now there are two child care assistance programs. There's the MFIP child care program and the basic sliding fee program.
Okay.
And what this bill would do is forecast the basic sliding fee program, essentially getting rid of it so that it would be a forecast program enrolled in, and then there would be an entrance and exit level for that program for families.
Thank you.
Okay. See no further questions. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair.
Oh,
I did.
Okay. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moran, order your testifier. I just want to make sure I understand the bill. I wrote down some things I think the bill does, but if you could help me out with that, I'd appreciate it. So I think what the bill does is it increases the child care rates we're paying providers because it hasn't increased in many, many years. It also eliminates the waiting list for child care in Minnesota. And it also provides tax relief to low-income families in Minnesota. Is that a true representation, or am I missing some things, or am I overstating what the bill does?
Mr. Hoggy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is the case. It also, I mean, it increases eligibility for child care assistance, and then funds some professional development opportunities.
And then, Mr. Chair,
Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hoggy. So, what is the cost of all that to the state of Minnesota, for one?
Mr. Hoggy.
It's not cheap. I haven't seen a specific fiscal note on there. Right now, we spend. Minnesota spends $415 million per biennium on child care assistance. That's a combination of federal and state and some county dollars. But as Representative Moran stated and Mr. Ellis alluded to, I mean, the cost of not investing is even greater.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hauge, you know, I would like to ask you to do better in that regard, and let me state why. I'm an analyst by trade. I have an accounting degree and an analytical background. I really want to know that because I think that's critically important, and so I do want to understand the cost and the benefit because it's extremely important to get those numbers correct. Can you be a little bit more specific regarding the cost of not doing it is greater? I know we talked about the cost of incarceration. I don't even know what we spend. I'm not on any of the committees that talk about that. I'm sure it's a large number as well. Just expand on that thought process for a little bit.
Mr. Hauge, but in a very narrow way, because that's really belongs in a different committee than ours that has money. So narrowly, just answer it quickly. Or Representative Moran, do you want to?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, and so what we do know is that when we are investing in early childhood education, right, we are allowing our kids to enter kindergarten ready and prepared, reading by third grade, and in turn, they are more amped to be more successful in school and in life and to get a job, not be in poverty, you know, because we know currently right now we have kids who are failing within our school system, and the burden falls on our state and us in the long term. And so by half, where you have 6,000 children waiting to enter to a quality daycare center, it has huge impacts on their lives, short-term and long-term. So So what we're saying is that it's a great investment. Is the cost to that to have kids to be a part of a quality daycare center, but it costs even more when we don't create an opportunity and a path for kids to be a part of that quality system.
Well, Representative Barrett, they're just on your question, of course, the famous study by Art Rolnick at the Federal Reserve was $17 we save for every $1 we spend on early childhood. And that was a study, pretty thorough study, that's cited nationally. Representative Mayer.
Mr. Chair, I had the opportunity to talk to his co-author, and one of the things that he pointed out about that is it was 16 to 1, but it was highly disadvantaged children. So you can't get that same rate of return on just the general population.
And Representative Meyer, I know that, but many of the children that are receiving this type of funding are in that at-risk category. So. Nobody can come up with exact figures on that, Representative Barrett. And then we have to move on to the next.
Sure, I'll be quick, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just for one quick question. I'm concerned or thoughtful, I guess, maybe a better way to phrase it, on the cost to counties. And I'm just wondering if you could explain to me, I don't know how to get there because we don't know the cost of this benefit we would be providing under the bill yet. But even taking the $415 million current cost, how is that spread out between federal, state, and county costs?
Mr. Hauge? Ms.
Rowe? Chair, Representative Baird, I'm going to defer again to our good, smarter friends at the department who have a better sense of that.
I do that a lot, too.
Yeah.
Ms. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a county share currently in the basic sliding fee program that share totals $3 million across all counties. It's a fixed dollar amount per county.
Thank you. Representative Barrett, is there a really important question burning, or can we we have to move on?
All questions are burning. No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Barrett, I'd be happy to talk with you more as well offline about some of the quality studies and try to get some of those to you if that'd be helpful. And if you've, I don't know if the committee has seen, had presentations from Mr. Rolnick or anyone from the Reserve, but.
I've seen it many times. okay, Representative Moran renews her motion to pass House File 951 and re-refer it to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Representative Fortman. The chair will move House File 430 for Representative Fortman, and that also goes to Health and Human Services Finance, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Mr. Chair, okay. For moving my bill. House File 430, we call the Family Economic Security Act, and the principle is very simple, that a family's economic security affects the well-being of the children. And the bill has three main components, and it's designed as a follow-through to the work of the Commission to End Poverty. Minnesota convened a Commission to End Poverty just a few years ago. Representative Mariani was one of the members on that. And the group came up with a number of proposals that we could undertake in the state of Minnesota to dramatically reduce the number of Minnesotans living in poverty. And one of the things we're really good here at the legislature at doing is studying things. We are less good at implementing the recommendations once the study has been completed. This bill is an attempt to move that work forward. The three components of the Family Economic Security Act are, first, to raise the minimum wage. Many families in Minnesota who are poor are working, and they are poor because they are not making enough money. The second component is increasing the availability of child care. It's impossible for people to go to work if they don't have a place for their children to be that's secure and high quality. The third component of the bill would enhance the family tax credits. There's two different tax credit components. One is expanding the working family tax credit, and two is creating a state version of the child tax credit. Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you would like us to focus on the child care aspects of the bill, with that being the portion of the bill that's in your committee's jurisdiction. and we can focus on that piece if you would prefer.
Representative Fortman, basically, we don't want to hear anything about the minimum wage. We want to hear about the child care assistance modification. We don't want to hear about the money appropriated. That's a different committee. Only as a vague generalization do we want to hear about the two tax and more the child care tax credit, if it is. The other one is really not at all here. So is that kind of...
That's very helpful, Mr. Chair. I figured we would want to focus on the child-related items in this committee.
And not specifics too much on the tax credit part of the child care.
Right. Mr. Chair, and the bill that you just heard by Representative Moran is similar to ours, and the concept is making child care available to all the families who need it. Right now, there are families who need and qualify for our sliding fee child care but do not receive it, and the bill would address that. I have five testifiers with me today, and I'd like to briefly introduce Alexandra Fitzsimmons from the Children's Defense Fund as my first testifier.
Go ahead, Ms. Simpkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you to Representative Portman. Jobs Now and JLC and Children's Defense Fund have been working on this legislation with Representative Portman for quite a while, and we've really enjoyed working on this together. So my name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund primarily works on two issues. We work on policies that improve the well-being of children, and secondly, we work on policies that strengthen the economic security of families. And we believe that this bill does both. And even with what Representative Mullery just shared on what our testimony is going to focus on, I do have a visual for today with our Family Economic Security Act, because we do believe that these three pieces, so you see we have three houses here. My little boy would not let me bring the family that lives inside the house, so you'll just have to imagine that there's a family that lives inside. But that we have these three policies. We have the tax credits, we have the child care, and we have the minimum wage that work well and work very effectively together. So with that, I just want to focus on the economic security of families and what we know about how critical it is to the health and well-being of children. We know that children from families with sufficient financial resources are far more likely than children from economically disadvantaged families to start kindergarten ready to succeed and to flourish in school and later in life. Families with greater financial resources can better meet basic needs and provide enriching opportunities for their children. Findings from a 2011 Brookings Institution study examining the effects of family income on school readiness suggest that an additional $1,000 of average income during early childhood can result in higher reading and math scores for children in low-income families. As the wages of low- and middle-income working Minnesotans continue to stagnate, the cost of housing, utilities, food, childcare, healthcare, transportation continue to increase. It costs a family of three, one adult, and two children, approximately $46,000 a year to meet basic needs. Yet a parent working full-time earning the federal minimum wage has a gross income level of a little over $15,000 a year. I want to focus briefly on the cost of housing and child care in Minnesota. In Washington County, for example, fair market rent for a modest two-bedroom apartment is $904. In terms of a wage, a worker would need to work 96 hours per week at the federal minimum wage in order to afford that rent. In Douglas County, fair market rent is $596, and a worker would need to earn $11.46 an hour or work 63 hours per week. As far as child care in St. Louis County, licensed family-based child care for an infant is $6,800 per year and $6,400 for a toddler. In Blue Earth County, licensed center-based child care for an infant is $8,700 per year and $8,100 for a toddler. Low income and resulting material hardship affects parenting and child outcomes. It increases family stress, including the types of toxic stress that affect brain growth and development during a child's earliest years. Material hardship, such as food insecurity and substandard housing, can constrain the time and money parents can invest in their children, can lead to parental stress, depression, and poor health, which can directly affect children's social-emotional development. Before closing, I want to leave you with a few numbers. First, when the Economic Policy Institute analyzed the impact of the Harkin-Miller proposal to increase the federal minimum wage to $9.80, they found that 284,000 Minnesota children would be impacted by that increase, that they would have at least one parent who would be affected. Number two, according to the USDA's cost of raising a child calculator, it costs a family of four, two parents, two children ages 2 and 6 living in the Midwest, with income less than $59,000 a year, $17,500 per year to raise their two children. And lastly, a child from a low-income family who enters first grade has been exposed on average to just 25 hours of one-on-one book reading, whereas an entering middle-income child has been exposed on average to more than 1,000 hours of such reading. We believe it is important to consider the Family Economic Security Act policies from the perspective of child well-being, and especially the well-being of our youngest children. We believe in the value of all children as children, but oftentimes we talk about how our policies will impact the lives of children as future parents, teachers, child care providers, lawyers, nurses, and yes, even legislators. We must place this bill within the continuum of school readiness, school success, and school achievement. Family income affects investments in children. Strengthening the economic security of families will help children and will help our community. So thank you for your time and your dedication, and we're excited to be part of this important discussion.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chair, my second testifier is Chris Jacobs from the Jobs Now Coalition.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. I haven't talked to you in so long.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
About 12 hours. go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm Chris Jacobs with Jobs Now Coalition. I will shorten my testimony today since you've asked for the minimum wage to be a secondary discussion. I will say that the Family Economic Security Act goes a long way with the work supports that families need. You just heard Alex testify to the great need when you're raising a family and trying to keep a community together and be able to be with your kids. Last week, DEED released its new job vacancy survey. And while it's indeed true that we are finally seeing growth in the number of high-wage job openings, there are also, I lost my place here, more low-wage job openings than ever. 40% of all job openings are part-time. The median wage for part-time job openings is $9.41 an hour. A quarter of all job openings are in two large industries, retail trade, accommodation, and food services. For openings in these two industries, the combined median wage is $8.31 an hour. In both of these low-wage industries, jobs fell sharply during the Great Recession, but they have increased dramatically over the last 3 years. In retail trade, job openings rose by 183%. In accommodation and food services, job openings more than tripled, rising by 224%. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Rushi, next. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Brian Rushi, Executive Director, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. And we do the consensus agenda of the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. I'm here to give our full support to House File 430 and thank Representative Hortman and you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill today. I think it's important, just a little bit of background, that when the Legislative Commission on Poverty did its study, it contracted with the Urban Institute, a national think tank, to run some policy simulations on what would be the best policy levers to be on in terms of bringing the poverty rate down. Child care funding, minimum wage, tax credits. Those were the three main pieces that they researched. And attached to my letter that I had distributed to the committee on the second page, you'll see a chart that shows the overall changes in the poverty rate when you do those things together. And that's why we constructed the Family Economic Security Act the way we did. The three policy changes interact together in powerful ways, so you get a bigger effect than if you were just to do one at a time. They work together. They cement people's attachment to the workforce. They make the incentive for work higher. They put cash in families' pockets. Powerful effects. The last thing I want to mention, because you don't want to talk about the minimum wage, but on the tax credit piece, just to underscore what Alexandra Fitzsimmons said, every $1,000 of income matters in powerful ways. It affects test scores. It affects child well-being. It affects long-term success rates. And if you look at the House research bill summary, you'll see that we're expanding the working family credit so that you're getting about $1,000 more for one child, $1,800 more If you have two children, those are the maximum credits. And then the per-child credit would be in another $100 per child if you were in that range of income before it phased out. So we think we're on the right policy track here by putting these things together as a policy approach to address really disturbing policy or poverty experiences of the last couple of years. Poverty rates are rising. I know in my sector, in the faith community, we're seeing food shelves and shelters overflowing. And one of the statements I make in my letter is it's just important that we put working families in a position where they can buy food at a grocery store and sleep indoors. That's what we're talking about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Elwood, are you, is Ms. Hudson also, or just you?
Yeah, no, as we do the trading places, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say with a joint religious legislative coalition is a coalition of faith leaders in the Catholic, Lutheran, Jewish, and Muslim faith. And I always say if the Catholics, the Jews, the Muslims, and the Lutherans are all with you, who can be against you? So with that, I'd like to introduce the drummer for the band Not Quite Dead.
I've heard him. I've heard him perform, Mr. Elwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you, just one second, could more to towards what's in this committee than the taxes or the minimum wage parts? Hopefully.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I will absolutely do that. I will speak to the child care piece.
Thank you.
And I just want to put it briefly in a larger frame. All these this act, which is we support, is directed towards an important goal, which is asset building, because without having the assets and wealth to move through the spectrum of income instability, then we'll never get folks to family financial stability, and that's the goal that we all share. And that's why this is such an important bill, because of the many aspects of it, all of which are directed towards an asset building strategy, the building blocks of an asset building strategy. Certainly an important one is a child care assistance program. It's not the direct financial tangible benefit that's, for example, the Working Family Tax Credit provides, but it is an important asset nonetheless, because it allows parents to work or get an education, and it helps children with school readiness and socialization. And I would just point out that as of December 2012, there were 6,000 families on the waiting list, and that is holding families back from moving towards financial stability. So thank you very much. We really support the bill and appreciate the opportunity to testify, and thank Representative Portman for bringing the bill.
Thank you. Now, there's somebody sitting there, and it really doesn't look like Ms. Hugdahl.
No,
you have another
one. It is my testifier. Reverend Nancy Meeker.
Okay, Ms. Reverend Meeker, what?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Nancy Meeker, and I am an ELCA pastor and the executive director for A Minnesota Without Poverty, which is a statewide movement to end poverty in Minnesota by 2020. I'm grateful that for most of my life, I've lived in a family which could be described as middle class. While my ancestors were hard-working Germans, the real reason we grew up in middle class was because of one thing, and that is because of public policies that were enacted over 100 years ago. Those public policies allowed my family to be property owners, even landowners. Without those public policies of many years ago, my immigrant ancestors would have been poor and would have stayed poor, and their hard work would never have been enough to move them into middle class. Those public policies opened the door to a stable family income, to educational opportunities, to owning our own home, to providing our children even with enough of the basics of life, a good education, family stability, and even the opportunity and the privilege of paying taxes. I tell this family story to let you know something that you already know. And that is that what you do here in this building and in the building across the street is really important. The policies you enact have the potential for creating families where education is possible, where families can gain stability, where they have the basics of life. Your policies will reverberate in the lives of children and families today, but also for generations to come. What you do and the decisions you make are very important. As you've already heard, the Family Economic Security Act is a combination of such public policies that hold the potential for more families to move toward and to enter into middle class, all the while providing for children and their children with the tools that they need to succeed in school and become healthy, happy, productive adults. So I'm going to say the bad thing: raising the minimum wage to $9.50, making childcare accessible and affordable for working families, and increasing tax credits for families. As Brian already mentioned, these are the policies that the Urban Institute simulated for the bipartisan legislative committee to end poverty
Reverend,
in Minnesota.
Meal, we really have to.
Okay.
We've got people that get to testify on the other side, and then we have questions. And
One sentence. Okay. We believe there is enough for all to have enough if we all do our part, and I ask that you do your part to support the Family Economic Security Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Jamie Poole asked to testify, and then Benjamin Gerber. Is there anybody else that needs to testify on this? Okay, those two will take it, and then questions. Ms. Poole, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I am Jamie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I am here to speak tonight to the minimum wage portion of this bill.
Oh, well, then we're not taking any testimony on minimum wage. The other committees get to fight that out,
right,
and we don't have the fun of that.
Okay, perfect.
Mr. Gerber, are you on minimum wage or tax credits or actually on the child care?
Just the minimum.
Then you're not going to, no, we're not
going
to, you have to be lucky to be on one of those committees. It's kind of like I get the lucky ones. I'm on one of those, and I was on the guns committee, so I was really, Representative Myra first, Barrett, and then Franson. Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
Representative Hortman, are the direct payments to providers still considered to be on behalf of the eligible family, or is it a payment to the provider for services rendered to the state?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, I think that is the same question you asked on the previous bill, and I think the answer is the same for this bill, and probably more properly should come from the department since they handle that piece. Unless it's the same, then she doesn't need to come down and say the same.
It's the same. She nodded, it's the same. Did you have another question? Okay, Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a few questions about the minimum wage.
Nope.
So regarding the poverty rate, you know, it's really important. You had mentioned it, Representative, that government doesn't do it. They don't do a good. They do a good job of analyzing and implementing. And I would argue we don't do a good job of analyzing what we've already done. And so my question for you, and anyone really who has the answer, I'm not sure if anyone would or not, probably does. But how has the poverty rate changed in Minnesota over the past period of time? Let's say from 1990 to 2000 to 2010. And then I might as well tell you my second question. Why has that changed? If you look at cycles, we should be able to analyze what public sector policies have implemented that or have caused or helped to cause a positive or negative.
Or is this
I think Mr. Rushi really tracked the Legislative Commission's work and would probably the best person to answer that question.
Mr. Rushi?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, the poverty rate's been going up over the last 12, 15 years. We've reached a high, or maybe you call it a low watermark, depending on your perspective, but we're slightly over 10% in the general population, and disturbingly for this committee, the poverty rate for children is over 15%, so about 1 in 7 Minnesota kids lives below the poverty line. The reason for that, I think, are two things. The economic slowdown, the recession had a big effect on that, but over the longer run, I think the biggest evil out there is the detachment of wages and productivity, because workers have been more productive, but they're not getting the wage increases. And I would say partly that's due to a rotting wage floor, partly. Part of the commission's report actually looked at some new definitions of poverty and piggybacked some of their work on what had happened at the National Academy of Sciences, suggesting some new benchmarks for what is really the poverty rate. And I would encourage you to look at the report. That part of the report is pretty instructive and was part of the modeling that they did.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. Well, I've taken a little bit of a look at it, and I know in 1990 the poverty rate was 10.2%. In 2000 it was 7.8, and now it's up to 7.9 in 2000. Now we're up to 10.8. So it's gone down and it's gone up. Went down in 2000 because of the tech bubble, you know, in the late 1990s, in which we had a lot of people employed. And so we really haven't talked a lot about jobs here. We've talked about minimum wage. We've talked about tax credits. We've talked about child care. I would argue that the way out of poverty is a job, a good quality job. And I think if you look at the historical poverty rates, you would see that as a cause and effect. And well, so I'm wondering if you could comment. I'll give you a couple minutes to comment about the fact that it's no simpler than a good paying job.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree more with you about the value of jobs and decent-paying jobs, and point out that this modeling that the Urban Institute did showed that we would pick up about 35,000 more jobs with this proposal. It would generate $10 billion of new net wages and would save the state $2.6 billion a year because of the effects it would have on wages and attachment to the workforce.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Just a final, without mentioning the word minimum wage, I know the grocers are going to talk to other committees about the effect of that minimum wage on their very low profit margin. So for those of us that are just understand how important it is that jobs happen, you know, there is some negative consequence. We haven't talked about that. We'll probably will in another committee. But there are some negative consequences on wage increases, especially with
Chair,
low margins. I know we can't talk about in this committee, so I'll be quiet now. But
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, I think that one of the things that the
Mr.
grocers...
Rushi, you can
I'm sorry.
Go very briefly, but we're going to have to end that part of question.
I just think we're going to increase demand for people shopping
this isn't
at the grocery
the committee
store.
For that. This is committee for child care assistance. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I know we can't talk about minimum wage here, but, you know, when we want to make child care more affordable, could you please explain what does it mean to fully fund child care? It's kind of vague.
Mr. Rushi, or...
Well, right now it's, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, right now it's a appropriation level, it's capped, and so when people apply for child care assistance and there's not enough money, they go on a waiting list. And we have, I think Eric Hagi said 6,200 right now around the state, families that are waiting. And so when you forecast the program, it means eligible families would get child care assistance.
Thank you, Representative Fran.
Thank you, Mr. Mullery. Well, my fear is that if minimum wage is raised, that's going to cause employers in my district, which I've talked to lay off.
Representative Friends, and we're not talking
no,
about
it, I'm tying it into child care.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm going to have employers laying off employees. Yep, I've talked to them. I know my district, sir. And I know that your team is pushing this agenda through. but also I represent my district. I'm very concerned about the harmful effects that this is going to have on my businesses, because they have told me indeed that they will have to lay off people because there is only so much capital. If they lay off people, that's only going to increase the waiting list on child care, because we're going to have unemployed people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Franzen, I know we're not supposed to talk about the minimum wage here, but when some committee members make a statement about their opinion of the effect of such a policy, I think the counterpoint has to be pointed out, which is that economic studies show that economic activity increases when the minimum wage goes up, and the data shows in a state that raises it, folks go to the cafe and they spend more money. They go to the grocery store and they spend more money. At John's Auto Parts in Blaine, where I helped run our family business for 10 years, the thing that made our business work was people walking in the door who had money in their pockets who could buy parts. If people don't have money in their pockets, we can't create jobs for anybody. And that's what this bill is, not just about that piece, but significantly the interplay of the three pieces. And how when a family has more money, their children do better. I think we all know, we've all been at different stages in our lives where income has been higher or lower, and it's been harder or easier to pay the bills and look at how much you have left over at the end of the month. And I would say that each one of us knows in our own family that when we are more economically successful, it's beneficial for the children in our family, because we can give them the time that they need and the family stress level is lower. So there's an interplay between child development and family economic security that this bill is really about.
Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate if Ms. Rowe could come and answer my question that I posed earlier, please.
Ms. Rowe, could you sit down? Ms. Rowe, go ahead. The question, do you want to restate it for her?
Yes.
It's quite a while ago.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Rowe, are direct payments to providers still considered to be on behalf of the eligible family, or is the payment to the provider for service rendered to the state?
Ms. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wish I had brought the statute up with me, but the payment is made on behalf of the eligible family. I'm not certain that, so that is true. I'm not certain that what the alternative that you're putting forward is. So maybe we can discuss that outside of the hearing.
Representative Meyer, I think that's going to have some research.
Okay.
Representative Frisia.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. And Representative Portman, thank you very much. And thank you for the advice earlier when we connected up. I have 15 questions, none of which apply to thou shall not, which be named. No, I just have a couple.
Questions. You can come back by yourself at midnight.
I just have a couple quick ones. First of all, I want to talk about, Representative Portman, the interplay you talked about. It seems, with what you're trying to accomplish here, that it may be a very delicate balance. If one or two pieces, and we'll just use Myron France's three-legged stool, if one of those is shorter than the other, will that impact the piece that we're dealing with here?
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative
Crecia.
You know, the interplay is important. I would say that there's different pieces of the policy proposals moving in different ways. So if House File 430 doesn't get enacted with its piece that shall not be named, the child care piece and the tax credit piece as one bill, I don't think that we won't see the positive effects, because there is a bill on that topic, House File 92, that's moving, that I believe will pass in some form. And then the tax bill will contain some policies which I presume will be beneficial to middle-class families, whether it has this exact proposal or not. I think the goal at the end of the day is to have better economic security for families, but the specific piece before this committee in terms of availability of child care is just really critical for making sure that families can work. You know, part of this is about the well-being of children. But the other part that I'm in favor of is making work pay.
because we want families to be working. And if the work doesn't pay, and if there's no availability of decent child care that people can afford, they can't work.
Representative Crescia, one more question.
Just one more? But I have 12. Representative Mullery, thank you. Okay, so the other one is, as I look at page 2, the section 2.19 to 2.23, the issue that I would bring up, and you can clarify for me on this, is the issue of the transient people moving from county to county. And under this, as I understand it, it says one could move from a county that has benefits to one that also has benefits but would jump in front of those and not need to be put on the waiting list. My concern is if I had districts from Greater Minnesota, or families from Greater Minnesota that might move into the metro and there's a waiting list, are they now jumping ahead of those that you are trying to help?
Who wants to answer that? Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crescia, the idea is that the family would continue their child care. So if a family from Greater Minnesota moved into the metro area, and if they were, the family was receiving child care assistance when they were in Greater Minnesota, that when they got to Hennepin County or Ramsey County, they wouldn't lose that child care just by virtue of the fact that there's a waiting list here.
Thank you. Representative Crescia, if you have another actual question on the bill like that one, that was on the bill, so go ahead.
So was the other one. Thank you, Chair Mullery. And yes, okay, so my concern there is if we already have a county that's constrained to that, do you see any challenges of pushing people further down on the waiting list because there's other families that are moving in ahead of them?
Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crescia, in my bill there are no waiting lists because we fund everybody who needs it.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have to move on. The chair renews his motion to pass House File 430 and re-refer it to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Thank you. Representative Halverson. Does somebody want to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Somebody want to move the bill? 362. HHS Finance.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that House File 362 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Right.
352.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Halverson, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to talk about House File 362, and thank you for hearing this bill.
Just 1 second. I guess you have an author's amendment, is that?
I do have an author's amendment, yep.
Is that the A1?
Yes.
Representative Winkler moves the A1 amendment to put it into the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really happy to be bringing this forward today. It's a fairly simple bill, and you won't get to hear much from me today because you get to hear from the experts. But just as a reminder, MFIP is a program that provides temporary assistance to low-income families here in Minnesota with one or more children under the age of 18 and to pregnant women. The stated goals of MFIP, I think, are really important in this case, and that is to expect, support, and reward work. There's a lifetime limit on MFIP of 5 years, and most families are off MFIP in 2 years. Relative to this bill, we see job counseling, cash support, food and child care assistance that are all provided to these families to meet these goals of MFIP and the goals of work. Because MFIP helps low-income Minnesotan families find work while they're providing for their families, this bill is going to also allow parents to seek mental health services, and which will provide them the ability to follow their prescribed treatment plan. And I think that everybody will agree, and I'm sure we'll hear from the experts, that it is vital that folks who have the goal to be supported in the workplace are able to carry out their prescribed mental health treatment plan. And with that, I would like to ask our testifiers to fill in the rest of the gaps on this.
Thank you. Marcy, are you first? Which one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank Representative Halverson for bringing this important bill. I have a handout, if the page could distribute that. Representative Halverson is correct. This is a
just 1 second. How long have you been around here? I won't go further on that.
At least
but
75
I think
years.
You. I thought by now you would remember that you have to state your name first.
Oh. I was going to get there. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Marcy Jeffries with the Children's Defense Fund. So this is a very important bill. For one of the reasons that Representative Halverson mentioned is allowing parents to access mental health treatment. The research that you've heard in this committee earlier has demonstrated how important it is that parents are able to parent their child, respond to their children's needs as best they can. And for some parents, mental health issues get in the way. Many of our MFIP policies actually make it more difficult for them to access mental health services. So there's really two parts to this bill. The first part is about allowing parents to obtain child care so they can seek mental health treatment. Sue Abderholden from the National Alliance for Mental Illness is usually testifies on this bill and tells a story about a family she was working with. A mother was seeking mental health treatment. She was in an office. She had to leave her children in the waiting room while she was seeing a therapist, and somebody called Child Protection Services while she was seeing a therapist, and so that started that whole system in motion. The other part of the bill that I want to talk about is the second part that relates to children in MFIP child-only cases because their parents are on a supplemental security income. For parents who have a mental illness or other disability so serious that they cannot work, they are eligible for supplemental security income, and their children are still eligible for MFIP. So those children are in what we call MFIP child-only cases. We don't know a lot about those children, the well-being of those children, but what little research we do have shows that they are at high risk for developmental problems and not being ready for school because of the double whammy of both poverty and then parents who have serious mental illness. The Department of Human Services did an excellent report in 2010. It was a one-time study looking at these children and found that on nearly every measure of family and child well-being, families receiving MFIP child-only assistance fared poorly compared to other families on MFIP, as well as Minnesotans in general. For instance, they found that 55% of the SSI-eligible caregivers had a diagnosis of severe mental health disorder, and 24% of the children in these MFIP child-only cases were in special ed. But under our current policies, these children are not eligible for child care assistance because their parents are not working. As a result, combination of often being home alone without any opportunity for other stimulating opportunities and the poverty, the low rate of income that their families are in, often leaves these children not ready for school and hurts their academic achievement. And there's quite a bit of research related to that, and that's summarized on the second side of the handout. So again, this bill allows parents to arrange up to 20 hours of child care for their children. We think it will have long-term impact in many systems, and we'll see children doing better in school. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Regan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Regan with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. Marcy told the story that I was going to tell for Sue Abderholden. I would just add that I know the committee has heard about the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, and their impact on the long-term well-being of people. And one of those adverse experiences is having a parent with a mental illness. So I really think this is a simple, straightforward opportunity to give both the parent and the child a break, time away, and some support, mental health support for the parent and support for early learning for the child. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone that wants to testify on this otherwise? Okay, then I think Representative Myra had a question.
I'll make it really quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, how many families would this bill affect?
Representative Halverson.
Ballpark is fine.
I do have that number. I just have to get the right piece of paper. Mr. Chair and Representative Myra, totally, MFIP serves about 41,000 families, over 41,000 families, and of all MFIP cases, about 48% of caregivers were diagnosed with a serious mental health condition in the last 3 years. That doesn't mean that all of those 48% of the MFIP parents are going to be served by this particular case because they're more severe. you may have an additional comment. Or?
Ms. Jeffrey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think there's the two parts to the bill, so potentially there are the parents with mental health issues, but whether or not they would be seeking a treatment, certainly not all of them would that apply to. The other part of the bill is the refers to the MFIP child-only cases. So about a third of the cases on MFIP are MFIP child-only cases, and then of those, about a half are the SSI-eligible cases, and then some portion of them would probably take advantage of this 20 hours a week of child care. I would say in general these families are, the children are a little bit older, so again they probably would not be seeking the child care piece at the same rate.
Okay. Representative Myra, did you follow? Representative Howell, you're next, I guess.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question goes to the amendment, and as we, how many people are we actually adding when we eliminate that exemption for the work requirements? I mean, so the people that now are exempt, I take it that now the people that, and I know this is confusing because it was confusing when I was looking at it, but so right now you have to be exempt from the work requirements to be eligible, and now we're going to take that out of there, so now we're opening it up to more people the way it looks to me. So my question is, how many people are we going to add to this?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, it actually doesn't add anybody. It's the language was duplicative because, as Ms. Jeffries pointed out, a number of these, this portion of the bill is dealing with folks who already have that work exemption because of they're part of the SSI disability group, or they have a work exemption for another reason. So essentially this language was pulled out because it was just unnecessary. It was duplicative of what is already in the bill and already in statute, actually.
Representative Howe, did you have? No. Okay. No other further questions? Okay. Representative Winkler renews his motion to pass House File 362 as amended and re-refer it to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Before I announce the adjournment, I was just going to announce that for Thursday's meeting on the child care and the issue of unionization, we're going to enforce the 24-hour rule on amendments. So, okay, with that, the meeting's adjourned.